I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Political races in Pennsylvania often pit the eastern portion of the state against the western, but that's not the case in the Democratic primary for state attorney general. WHYY's Katie Colinari looks into how a district attorney from Pittsburgh has gained big-time support in Philadelphia.
Stephen Zappala is bringing people together in Philly. Take his new campaign ad, featuring Mayor Jim Kenney and his primary rival, State Senator Tony Williams, sitting on a stoop.
When we ran for mayor, we didn't agree on everything.
I'll say.
Now, we agree on some really important things.
We're both voting for Steve Zappala for attorney general.
But before you start humming Kumbaya, know that Montgomery County Commissioner Josh Shapiro, the frontrunner in the race, endorsed Kenney in the general election. Spokesman Marty O'Rourke says the mayor is supporting Zappala because of his experience as a prosecutor. He says it has nothing to do with John Dougherty, the powerful Philadelphia union leader who helped get Kenney elected and who's helping Zappala. Dougherty says the two families go way back.
The Doughertys and Zappalas have known each other for years. I've known Steve, every bit of 20 years.
Zappala's father, Stephen Sr., a former Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court, backed Dougherty's brother Kevin in his successful run for the high court last year.
We worked hard together, you know, in a state that's not accustomed to electing Democrats.
Another Philly Democrat behind Zappala is Congressman Bob Brady, the local party chairman. Brady says it's all about balance.
A reason why, Pittsburgh and Allegheny County out there comes out to vote. They have one of their own. And that's how we've been winning elections. That's how we won the Supreme Court. They supported two of ours out of the East. We supported two of those out of the West.
That's how it works, he says. The primary is April 26th. I'm Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
A top Veteran Affairs official today announced that by the end of the year, veterans will have access to same-day primary care and mental health services. As WHYY's Alana Gordon reports, the goals come in the wake of investigations into long waits for veterans seeking care in Philadelphia and beyond.
David Shulkin, the VA's Undersecretary of Health, says it's in the midst of an overhaul to improve access to care. Here he is in a recent USA Today interview.
We're putting in place systems that make sense to veterans. We're changing the way that we deliver care. We're now focused on clinical urgency.
Shulkin has now detailed new VA efforts to make sure veterans get care when and where they need it. One goal, being able to get same-day appointments. Jose Martinez leads the Veterans Group in Philadelphia. It's a nonprofit that runs a 41-bed home and helps hundreds of veterans with benefits and other needs each year.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think that for a veteran to be able to go and get same-day appointments, it's an amazing thing.
Martinez, a veteran himself, has found it is possible to get an appointment the same day, but you have to know how to work the system, who to talk to, what to say. He hopes these new efforts focus on making that process easier for all vets. He says a lot of people get discouraged when they try but hit a wall.
And they leave. And they leave. And they become homeless. They become chronically homeless. They're not on their medication.
The announcement follows nationwide investigations into VA wait times and staff being pressured to alter reports to reduce the appearance of delays. Philadelphia and Wilmington centers are mentioned in the reports. Officials in both places say they've been addressing the problem. I'm Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
Villanova University fans gathered in Center City, Philadelphia this afternoon to give their national champion men's basketball team a parade down Market Street. WHYY's Tom McDonald rode a bus as part of the parade to file this report.
The fans were 10 or more deep along the parade route, including high schooler Lauren Maraglia, who skipped classes to see the teammates from what she calls her future school.
Because you got to support them. It's the only Philly team that's doing well, you know? We're going to party like it's 1985.
And party they did. The players threw T-shirts and other souvenirs to the crowd from the top of an open double-decker bus. Paul Paravolek came from Havertown to welcome home the champions.
Bring the kids down, something exciting. A winning team in Philadelphia is very rare, so I thought I'd let them experience a celebration once in their life.
Once the team got to City Hall, Chris Jenkins, who hit that winning three-point shot Monday night, said he's savoring the title.
It's been an honor to be a part of this team, a part of this coaching staff. You know, we put a lot of hard work in this year, and this is something that nobody will ever be able to take away from us.
Head coach Jay Wright said he was impressed by the outpouring of support.
I promise you, this is just a warm-up for the Phillies, the Flyers, the Sixers, and the Eagles. We're going to do this again real soon, I promise.
The fans weren't so optimistic. One held a sign reminding people the Sixers have only 10 wins this season. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Still ahead this evening, a simulation exercise recreates the lives of refugees moving between borders.
People start to forget to be compassionate towards people who are fleeing situations that any one of us would flee from.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Who knew New York and then Pennsylvania would loom this large, this late in the presidential primary season, with the potential for a contested GOP convention ahead? Let's take the public's pulse with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, what do you say we get at this by contrasting Republican and Democratic voter satisfaction with their respective candidates?
Yeah, it's very fascinating because we have been tracking how everybody feels about the candidates themselves. And the bottom line is that Democrats are much more positive about both of their remaining major candidates than Republicans are about the three candidates who remain on their side. This suggests to us, and actually some evidence shows us, that if it's Sanders or if it's Clinton on the Democratic side, it may not matter that the Democrats are going to coalesce around the victor, so to speak, and go on and vote for them in November, even though right now, of course, Sanders and Clinton are fighting one another for the nomination. Let me give you the examples of exact data that we have. 71% of Democrats have a positive opinion of Hillary Clinton. 73% of Democrats have a positive opinion of Bernie Sanders. But when we switch over to the Republican side, we find just slightly above 50% of Republicans have a favorable opinion of Trump. About the same number have a favorable opinion of Cruz, and slightly below that have a favorable opinion of John Kasich, the governor of Ohio.
It seems like a huge disparity. Is there a precedent?
Well, a lot of times there is not. We typically find that people like their own party's candidate. I would guess the closest we've come to this might have been in 2012, when Mitt Romney, at about this time, was still fighting for his party's nomination, and his favorable rating among his own party was lower, clearly, than Obama's. He was the incumbent, of course, running for re-election back in 2012, but the comparison was not as stark as we find now.
I wonder the extent to which this speaks to the potential viability of a Paul Ryan or Mitt Romney, for example, looming in the wings.
Well, that's, of course, what everybody's talking about. We've got some other indicators showing that Republicans are not all that happy. They're lower now on how the process is working in general than they were. They're dropping. Democrats aren't. Republican enthusiasm has dropped down now, and that's a real key for turnout, which, of course, in today's modern America is a real key to winning elections. Maybe that does open the door to a candidate getting the nomination in Cleveland, which is what we're all going to be watching in July, other than the ones that are out there campaigning so heavily.
What do you say we turn from the players to the play itself, as all the brouhaha among the Republican candidates in turn damage support for the Republican Party?
Well, certainly we find fewer Americans are identifying with the Republican Party than has been the case. And this is a real key because we interview, 15 to 30,000 people a month, and we ask them all, what is your party identification? Democrats typically have had the higher party ID in recent years, more so than Republicans. And we're talking here about people who identify with the Republican or the Democratic Party and or lean towards that party when we probe them. Last fall, however, we found parity. 42% of Americans identified with both the Republican Party and 42% with the Democratic Party. But now that's spread again, and this is the bottom line. 46% of Americans, Democrats, 40% Republicans. That's a 6-point spread. That's big. Based on history, if that were to continue, that spread in party identification through next November, it would be a positive sign for Democrats in the election.
Frank, let's park politics. Now, despite protests by students who decried Woodrow Wilson's record on racial issues, the university announced this week that his name will remain on the School of Public and International Affairs as well as on a residential college. Frank, where do U.S. college students fall on the issue of schools acting to restrict the expression of viewpoints that upset or offend?
It depends on what those viewpoints are. We just did a study with the Knight Foundation where we interviewed a large number of college students around the country. And it really depends on what kind of offensive speech you're talking about, Dave. 69% of college students say that, yes, colleges and universities on their campuses should be able to restrict students using slurs and other language on campus that is intentionally offensive to certain groups. But go down to where we ask these college students about political views, And only 27% said that colleges should be able to restrict expressing political views that are upsetting or offensive to certain groups.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Every day, refugees flee areas in conflict. How does it really feel to be one of the displaced, and what happens to refugees when they arrive here? Those were questions some 100 participants explored by reenacting the journey of families between borders. WHYY's Elizabeth Perez-Luna reports.
Most refugees live in a state of suspended animation. They lose their sense of place and time and future. But just hearing their stories, do you truly understand what they're going through? That's what inspired Lila Thompson, a Temple University public policy scholar, to create a large simulation exercise that would bring the refugees' feelings of displacement and uncertainty to life.
There were, as of July of last year, 15.1 million refugees in the world. That's the highest level we've seen in.
For one entire day, Thompson transformed spaces at Philadelphia's National Constitution Center into makeshift offices, refugee camps, and health clinics, and populated them with volunteers playing the roles of officials. Thompson wanted to illustrate the refugees' personal journeys, which can take from 6 months to 5 years or more.
So essentially, it's putting individuals in a specific identity so that they can sort of take on the humanity of another person and understand every step of the process that they go through, from fleeing their home country, leaving everything behind, to going to a refugee camp, and understanding what it's actually like to live there. What is the food situation like? What is the school education system like? What are the things that you face on a daily basis?
To begin with, public participants were given an envelope with their refugee's story, with instructions not to break character from their assigned role.
I was a refugee from Syria to Jordan. Both of my parents were killed in front of me, and my only sibling was forced to enter the army. So I was all by myself. And
at the end of the day, when she returned to her real identity as a law student, Grace Shedden said it was powerful because
I would like to one day help people in the situation of the lady I'm playing today.
Story after story spoke of fear, hardship, resilience, and survival. This grandmother read the family's assigned narrative.
The last convoy that was leaving for Monrovia was the only chance we had. We first tried going to Sierra Leone. We went to Sierra Leone so we could enter back into Liberia through Lofa. But then we had heard they had captured Lofa.
Her family ended up staying for months at a Sierra Leone camp. Outside each camp, staffers from the United Nations Refugee Agency register and interview each family member to start the long process of relocation. They get a fat envelope of old and new documents to carry from desk to desk, from checkpoint to checkpoint. They wait until something happens. This Liberian family gets news from a man playing the role of a U.S. immigration official.
This family has been granted refugee status. We're going to get them on an airplane to the United States. And then within 18 months, mom and dad hopefully will get a job, and you'll need to pay back the cost of the flight.
Oh my gosh.
So we're going to...
Once in the U.S., the refugees receive assistance for a limited time and must find work, get settled, and begin their new life on their own after that. In 2014, nearly 70,000 slots were allocated to refugees in the U.S. This year, the proposed settlement number is 85,000, says Temple University law professor Jair Ramji Nogales. She's an authority in refugee law and policy and co-designed the Between Borders Project. The takeaway, she says, is not to forget that if you go far enough in most Americans' family trees, there's a history of refugees or displaced immigrants.
The concerning thing to me about what we've been seeing lately in a lot of the popular debate is that people start to forget to be compassionate towards people
who are fleeing situations that any one of us would flee from. I have two small children at home, right? And I look at these people fleeing with their children, and you have to understand that it has to be something really severe driving them to get on a dinghy with two small children and try to get to Europe.
The overall experience of the Between Borders Project was not lost on 21-year-old student Patricia Moore.
I think it gave me more perspective over what refugees go through to make it to another country. It gave me, I think, what I have now is more respect for them and for their struggle.
Elizabeth Perez Luna, WHYY News.
Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign stop in Philadelphia yesterday took a confrontational turn when protesters challenged former President Bill Clinton about decisions he made while in office. They sought to bring attention to his tough-on-crime policies that caused prison populations to grow in the 1990s. For NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones, while it's important to confront the truths of the past, selecting a new leader requires a focus on the future.
When former President Bill Clinton visited a Mount Airy Recreation Center to stump for his wife, Hillary, both supporters and protesters showed up. One of those demonstrators, Erica Mines, told me in an interview that she and fellow protester Rufus Farmer wanted only to silently hold Bill and Hillary Clinton accountable for the mass incarceration that resulted from President Clinton's 1994 crime bill. They wanted to call out Hillary Clinton, who in the 90s referred to young criminals as super predators. Both Bill and Hillary Clinton have since apologized, both for the results of the bill and for the remarks. But when confronted, Bill Clinton pushed back against the protesters' accusations, saying in part, "I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out into the streets to murder other African-American children. You are defending the people who killed the lives you say matter. Tell the truth." Well, here is the truth. In the 1990s, as crack infiltrated our communities, African-Americans suffered. Some, like myself, struggled through addiction. Others pursued drug dealing. Crime skyrocketed, throwing the community into chaos. Many black leaders called for law enforcement to stop the open-air drug markets, the murders, and the resultant destruction of black families. Here's more truth. Those black leaders should have known that the racial disparities that had always been part of our criminal justice system would continue under the crime bill. So while Erica Mines and others are right to highlight the disastrous results of the crime bill and the ongoing inequities in our system, there is another truth we can't forget. Hillary Clinton was not in office during her husband's presidency, and in my view, she is not responsible for his policies. She is, however, responsible for her own. I had an opportunity to see Hillary Clinton up close this week when she visited Impact Services, a social service agency that provides job training and other supports to help ex-offenders find work and become self-sufficient. In a Kensington neighborhood that has long been plagued by drugs, poverty, and crime, Hillary Clinton spoke to a group of young black men who were filling out job applications after brushes with the criminal justice system. Then she sat on a panel with Mayor Kenney, former Deputy Police Commissioner Kevin Bethel, and others working to reverse the tide of mass incarceration. She asked questions of the panelists, listened carefully to their answers, and shared what she would do if elected. That, more than anything, is what every candidate must do going forward. It's fine for protesters to demonstrate. It's understandable for President Clinton to defend his record. But at some point, we'll have to decide on the next leader of our country. That will require listening in the present, looking into the future, and avoiding the mistakes of the past. This election is far too important to do otherwise. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production by the intrepid Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Al Banks and Adam Steady Stanishevsky. John Mussoni is acting Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.